Hey guys, what's up? It is week 324. It's going to be kind of a short one for you. No update, just going to do my Patreon picks this time around. But let's start this off with a bang. First up is from 1982. It is 4K from MVD Rewind, and this is Swamp Thing. Now, I think that Lightyear recently put out Return to Swamp Thing on 4K, kind of distributed by MVD, sorry, but I believe that this is technically the first of the MVD Rewind Collection 4K, which is awesome. So yeah, Swamp Thing, like I said, directed it, made in 1982, directed by legendary horror director Wes Craven, Nightmare on Elm Street, Scream, Last House on the Left, and this is based off the DC comics of the same name that were, pretty popular. It had a couple renditions. This movie was not successful at first, but later it spawned a sequel in 89, directed by Jim Wynorski, and then it had a television series on USA, a live action, and then it had an animated TV series, which spawned a bunch of action figures and all that kind of stuff. So Swamp Thing, kind of a big deal, I guess. They had a more recent DC television program as well. So here we go. So basically, this follows a story of this scientist. They're working in this kind of like the swamps of, it's got to be Louisiana because it's so thick, right? And there's this evil kind of entity, this character known as Arcane. He's supposed to be dead and he wants what they're working on. And the doctor here is Ray Wise, and he's like trying to develop this thing to help like grow plants and make more food for people. And of course, in the vein of Darkman or something, the baddies come in and they mess up the lab and it causes this freak accident. And Ray Wise turns into Swamp Thing, played by Dick Duroc, who is this huge guy, and he would play the character in all the early renditions. The suit in this one's pretty rough. You know, the Swamp Thing suit in this is way rougher than I remembered. Now, I was always really kind of lukewarm on Swamp Thing for my entire life. I saw it as a kid and I was okay with it, but I saw it later in my teens and I was just like, man, that is not that great, kind of dull. But watching it this time, maybe it was the 4K because it looked excellent. But I just kind of had a fondness for it. Maybe it's just the idea of Wes Craven directing an early superhero movie. But, I recently watched Deadly Blessing for the first time by Wes Craven from 81. And I thought that was pretty good, you know. And I love his early stuff. Last House on the Left, Hills Have Eyes. And I, of course, love Nightmare on Elm Street. But Wes Craven's got a good handful of films. He's not always, you know, he always swings really hard. He doesn't always knock it out of the park. But I think Swamp Thing's pretty solid. It also, of course, has Adrian Barbeau, who was married to John Carpenter at the time, which I love because Adrian Barbeau would work with George Romero the same year on Creepshow 82, and she also worked with John Carpenter in several movies and everything like that, Escape from New York and whatnot. So it's funny that she's like one of the only people to work with Craven, Romero, and Carpenter, probably all in the same year. I'm pretty sure she was the voice in The Thing, so that's pretty awesome right here. And then also it has two kind of huge mainstays in the horror kind of genre world. It's got David Hess, who worked with Craven on, of course, Last House on the Left. He played Krug. He's also in House on the Edge of the Park, Hitchhike, Let's Get Harry. Cult icon, amazing actor, amazing baddie. He plays Ferret. He plays kind of the main henchman in this. He's really good. He's really fun. Love David Hess. And also, of course, Nicholas Wirth, who plays Bruno. Nicholas Wirth would appear in Invitation to Hell by Wes Craven, and of course, he was the voice in Hills Have Eyes Part 2, also for Wes Craven. But the thing about Nicholas Wirth is he's a great genre actor. He's in Darkman, Don't Answer the Phone from 1980. And I always point out that it's funny that David Hess and Nicholas Wirth both have roles in 1980. They both play kind of rapist perverts, and they both have the same end. I wonder if they ever talked about it on set here. But I love watching those two interact as these kind of goons. Now, Swamp Thing kind of walks the line. It's like, yes, it is kiddie kind of friendly, but it also has violence. Let's get this over with on the cuts, too, because we have the theatrical PG cut, that was United States cut, that was which is what you're used to on the Scream Factory Blu-ray and everything like that. And then we have the uncensored international cut, both in 4K. I watched the international uncensored cut because that's that version I never saw. And that, of course, has the Adrian Barbeau nude scene where she's bathing in the swamp. And it also has a party scene, which I did not know existed, where kind of Arcane's boys are celebrating after they think that they captured Swamp Thing and everything's going to be great. So there's naked women kind of wandering around and everything like that. And it seems like everybody's kind of having this drug-fueled party, which is kind of crazy to me, to be honest. I was like, I did not remember this scene. I guess the international audience wanted more nudity and everything like that. So and also, of course, Louis Jourdain is the villain in this, and he's kind of like a classy kind of guy. They say said he was going through a lot of stuff on the set, you know, because his kid had just committed suicide while he was making this movie, so he's kind of distant. That's what one of the actors said. There's some stuff ported over from the Scream Factory Blu-ray, of course, Interview with Adrienne Barbeau and stuff like that. There's a really nice kind of little featurette on here with Kim Newman talking about Swamp Thing and everything like that and where how it fits in Wes Craven's career. Also, the set designer is interviewed on here. There's several commentaries, three or four, I think, actually. I think several means five to seven, but there's a handful of commentaries on here as well. You can watch it in 4K or Blu-ray. It comes with both. So all in all, I just kind of was more happy with Swamp Thing than I had ever been. This is the best experience I've had with it, watching it. The 4K looks pretty good. It looks solid, has HDR. I thought some of the colors popped, and I mean, it takes place in like this crazy, dirty swamp and everything, and there's good contrast and everything like that. It's a well-made movie on a budget. My understanding is they cut a lot of the budget from Wes Craven, kind of were taking a lot away from him while he's making this movie. But overall, I kind of really enjoyed Swamp Thing. I think it's good stuff. And you know, I always kind of poo-pooed on Swamp Thing, but watching it this time, I actually enjoyed it. I love that they call this the Laser Vision Collection, kind of a shout-out probably to Laserdisc. But besides the features I mentioned, we also have, of course, audio commentary, writer-director Wes Craven, moderated by Sean Clark. This is on the theatrical version. All the commentaries are on the theatrical version. Audio commentary with makeup effects artist William Munns, moderated by Michael Felsher. Tales in the Swamp with Adrienne Barbeau. Hey Jude with actor Reggie Bates. He plays the kind of like child actor in this film. That Swamp Thing with Len Wein, creator of Swamp Thing. Swamp Thing's Swamp Screen, designing DC's main monster featurette. And From Krug to Comics, How the Mainstream Shaped a Radical Genre Voice featurette. And that has Kim Newman in it. But yeah, this is a good release, and I enjoyed it. There's a PG version and the unrated version on here, or the international one. But great cast in a solid B movie superhero movie that's a little ahead of its time. I kind of had a newfound appreciation for it. Now maybe that's the 4K, maybe that's just me getting soft, maybe that's Nicholas Worth and David Hess, Adrienne Barbeau and Ray Wise, Louis Jourdain. Good cast. So Harry Manfredini does the score, so you know, from the Friday the 13th movie. So it's like, it's very reminiscent of that. A little bit different though here. I mean, everything he kind of touches has the same kind of taste to it, you know what I mean? You can tell it's a Manfredini score, but it's pretty good. Yeah, I like this movie. It's fun. It's fun stuff. I mean, if you don't like it, you know, there's always the sequel that's even goofier, and maybe that's more up your alley. But Swamp Thing, good stuff. Okay, the next one up, because I watched Swamp Thing, I decided to pop in one that I had never seen from 1979. I've been doing 1980, 1981, so this is 79, not quite there, and this is Bawk. Yeah, and this is a double feature here. It also has Mako, The Jaws of Death by William Griffey. Now, I covered that movie, and I popped in this print to look at it. It looks pretty solid. I wonder if it's the same print used for the Arrow release, but the Arrow box set, the Griffey box set's really great. Mako, Jaws of Death is one of the best in the set. Richard Jekyll, great film. Very entertaining kind of exploitation film. If you're against, like, animals being hurt, which everybody is, but it's pretty graphic in this with sharks, steer clear. But Bawk, so this is the first time watch for me. It has some actors that I think everybody will recognize in Aldo Ray. He's kind of the big heavy in this. And Leo Gordon. Leo Gordon is in Intruder with William Shatner, the Roger Corman pitcher. I believe he's in that one. If that's where the name Leo Gordon popped up in my memory, I believe he's in that. But Aldo Ray, of course, you know, in a slew of horror movies, slew of B movies before that, he was kind of a bigger household name, infamous for kind of being one of these actors that was an alcoholic, you know, and as a long line of B movie actors tend to beat, unfortunately, even though they kind of usually show up. But so what we have here is, in the very beginning, this guy's dynamite fishing in a swamp. Good on him, right? And that's sarcasm. But he somehow disturbs something below. He gets pulled under, and boom, then we have a group of four, a couple married couples going out to fish, and the husbands obviously drug their wives along. They're not happy about it. There's a lot of complaining. They end up going fishing, and they get separated from their wives, and they're attacked. Their bodies are later found drained of all blood, like something happened. There's organic material down their throat. There's some scientists called in. They're all just rather confused by the whole incident. Aldo Ray is the sheriff. They do not know what's going on, and as they dig deeper, they start to realize that there's something non-natural here. There's a bog woman there. I'm going to call her Bog Woman. That's her Christian name. But she's starting to say strange things about the creature. And they have some sort of bond, of course. So the bog creature picks people off as the scientists discover more and more about it. They call in divers that get killed. Although Ray sure serves this monster up a bunch of people in here, okay? It's funny because it reminds me of, like, how incompetent the sheriffs are in 79. It would, like, carry on to, like, Alien Dead by Fred Olen Ray the next year. Just these people just not doing a great job. Just getting a lot of people killed. But I do like Aldo Ray in it. The monster monster is really cheap and he's really corny, and you don't see him until like the, towards the end of the film, but he's pretty fucking funny. I mean, it's in the vein of Creature from the Black Lagoon, right? And what does Creature want? He wants a mate. So of course this bog creature is looking for a mate. It's got, you know, these eggs that it's presenting, and it wants to carry on its thing. It's a pretty indestructible as well. And it would carry on that theme in the next year, 1980, with Humanoids from the Deep, which is very much in the vein of Bog or Creature from the Black Lagoon. But yeah, it's a cheap movie. The acting's not great. The story doesn't flow amazing. There's not really that many special effects. There is a really high kill count, though. And it's shot on location in a fucking bog. In a swamp, so you got to give it props there. Not many features on the disc. I thought it looked pretty solid for a what is obviously a low budget movie. And it does have that kind of exploitation kind of charm, or maybe a like a Bigfoot kind of movie, like Creature from Black Lake. If you guys have ever seen that one by Synapse, put that out recently. But yeah, Bog. I was happy with it. I'm glad I finally watched this one. It was kind of on my checklist for years. It's much better than Monstroid from 1980 or something like that, or Rana, the, you know, the or AKA Croaked. You know, it's better than those. It's actually a little, it's kind of charming. I kind of enjoyed it, you know. It's not as good as Swamp Thing, but hey. So I mean, I'm coming around. Maybe I'm just like, I was in a bog mood, so yeah. I don't want to bog this review down. I'm gonna cut that. That's out. I'm leaving it. I'm fired. Anyways, yeah, check it out. Double feature on here. This is from Dark Sky. These are pretty cool. Okay, this next one is from Cult Epics, and this is directed by, let me make sure I get her name right, Marlene Gorris, who did A Question of Silence, which I covered a couple weeks ago. Yeah, and this one's 84. That one, I think, was early 80s as well, and that movie is pretty excellent, pretty interesting film, and Broken Mirrors is no different. This is a really interesting one, has some of the same cast, of course, and it kind of has two storylines going on at once, and you're like, how are these connected? You kind of figure how they could be connected. So you have a brothel, and you have all these characters that are all kind of different walks of life, kind of in this European country, just kind of servicing men and everything like that. And we kind of see like the one coming in for the first time. So you kind of see she gets the rope. She's kind of alienated, and you're kind of wondering what her story is, why she does this. And throughout, you get her backstory more unveiled and everything like that. She has a young daughter and a husband at home who's just not really great. And the other ones, you see glimpses at their lives, and they all have different demeanors and different ways they fit in their community with the other prostitutes and everything like that. Their group kind of reminded me a bit of A Gun for Jennifer, the movie. They're kind of tight-knit group with how they talk and argue and everything like that with amongst each other. And then the other storyline is the color is more saturated, and then they start to kind of connect, the colors kind of mix a little bit. The color's more saturated, and it seems so strange because we have these women, sex workers that are in danger. You know, you think their life would be so dangerous, but the color's vibrant in there, and it is dangerous. There's dangerous things that happen to them, and scary and demeaning things, all this kind of stuff. But then at the same time, you have this kind of this stark looking other side, and these people that, you know, basically have everyday jobs, house moms, all this kind of stuff like that. And we're following this woman who is kidnapped, who's in Question of Silence. She's one of the main characters. She's kidnapped by this, you can't see the character's face, and she's brought into this room, and every day a picture's taken of her, and the guy doesn't want to talk, and she's being tortured. And we cut back and forth between these storylines until eventually we figure that they're obviously connected to a certain aspect. And I guess what they say at the end of this film, you know, is the standing up and leaving and doing these things, or taking this violent character and turning him into a mouse towards the end of the film, if you know, all this kind of stuff in there. And it's dark. I mean, it's a serial killer story. It also involves a lot of prostitution, and you just kind of feel for the characters within the movie, and they're very interesting. And the stuff that happens, there's one part in here where somebody's attacked, it's very similar to Unforgiven, but the scene, the way it's done, is so aggravating and so scary and so repulsive, and seems real. It genuinely felt very real. I mean, of course, there's nudity in here and sex, but it's not really exactly the kind of pleasant movie that people are looking for, that kind of stuff in here. But it's a really interesting look at it. I think this director really says a lot, or does a lot with their films, that a lot of people don't. Like A Question in Silence, I was like, I mean, that's kind of the way to approach stuff like that, I think. I think it's just intelligent enough to scare away the dummies from saying something rude. I mean, like, a dummy's not going to understand it, to get upset at the message, or if there's the you know what I mean, that kind of stuff. But I thought this was pretty good too. I'm kind of honestly like impressed with this person's films. I think that they're more intelligent than, you know, a lot of films, and I don't probably grasp every little detail in here, but I do think that this director should probably be, you know, celebrated. This is Broken Mirrors. This is good stuff. It looks great too. It's a good looking movie, interesting film. There's some features on here, of course, out of the commentary by film scholar Peter von Straten, interview with U.S. sex worker Margot St. James from the basically 1984. So yeah, check this out. I would recommend getting this. This is good stuff. All right, we're getting into those 1981 movies.
Woe be unto him who opens one of the seven gateways to hell, because through that gateway, evil will invade the world.
That'll live on and on, and no one will know as the years come and go of the horror from long time ago. In this little town, when the 14th comes round, there's a silence and fear in the air. Remember the morn that the legend was born, all the shock and the horror was there. Or the legend they say on a Valentine's Day is a curse that'll live on and on. And no one will know as the years come and go of the horror from long time ago. And no one will know as the years come and go of the horror from long time ago.
Boy, we got some weird 1981 movies. I did three of them this week, and I think these might be three of the weirdest ones, or two of the weirdest ones. It's a weird mixture, though. And this is the first one up here, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Miss Osborne, directed by Valerian Bolthacek. I always say his name wrong. He did the Bete from the 70s, which is a really good movie. And he did some other things like Immortal Tales. He's got a cult following. He's a pretty interesting, prolific, bizarre director. And this one is no different. It's got a great cast in here. I watched this years ago. This is one of the Arrow releases. It's the fifth U.S. release that Arrow put out here. This is, like I said, this is great stuff, though. An 81 movie. It has Uday Kier in it. It has Howard Vernon in it. It has Patrick Magny in it. So it's got a great little cast here. It's got some other familiar faces that you would recognize, too. So, boy, how do I go about this? It's a Dr. Jekyll story. The year previous, we had two Dr. Jekyll stories. I'm a fan of that story, the original one by Robert Louis Stevens, of course, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And it follows it to a certain extent in the very very opening. I mean, it does have similarities to Edge of Sanity, which would come out later in the 80s. This is highly sexualized, too, and goes a little bit places that a lot of movies wouldn't go, where it has its incestuous kind of tones as well. So Dr. Jekyll is played by Uday Kier, and he is working on kind of, we get some cops coming around. So he is working on, obviously, the serum to make himself younger, and he has a big kind of party at his house. This one's more isolated, kind of like, and almost the Night of the Living Dead, when the murders start, they kind of pin themselves in the room, which is kind of a good way to scale down the story of Dr. Jekyll. So in the beginning, a young girl is ravaged and beaten by, of course, Mr. Hyde, but we don't really see Mr. Hyde's face. And as it goes on, I mean, there's no secrets in this movie right from the beginning, right? Except the only thing is the mystery of, do the people know who Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, do they know the story and the unveiling there? But as we go on, he has all sorts of different colleagues. He has a general, of course, who has his daughter there. He has other doctors. He has religious. He has a priest. So there's like conversations at dinner about religion and science and alchemy and all these kind of things that you would have at that time. And it's interesting. It's good stuff. It's shot very well, and it has a dreamlike quality. Cloudy quality, almost surreal quality about it, which works really well with the film as well. And it has a high sexual nature, right? So when Dr. Jekyll actually turns to Mr. Hyde, his impulse is very sexual, right? It's aggressive and sexual, and he fucks some people to death. And it would appear that his unit is sharp and piercing, because that happens more than once with a female character and a male character, which is kind of crazy. Very untypical for, you know, a Dr. Jekyll story. I mean, there is Dr. Jekyll stories before this that you kind of explore bisexuality with, of course, the Hammer Pitcher, Dr. Jekyll's Sister Hyde, which is an excellent movie. I love that one. And it would go on later on to kind of doing that thing. And we have, of course, you know, that the idea of changing your personas and everything, like, and of course, you know, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hype, he would get more sexualized as he was Mr. Hype. But this one, like I said, Uday Kier is solid in it. Patrick Magny is unhinged as always. Howard Vernon is good as always. I mean, when you have Patrick Magny, it's kind of weird to have Howard Vernon too. It's like, I feel like these guys would play, are like competing for the same role, but you know, Howard Vernon's more downplayed. The kill count's fairly high, and a lot of it is edited kind of in a crazy way towards the end, where you kind of see the outcome of these characters. Now, the person who plays Mr. Hyde is different. He looks really creepy. But I do like the end. I like what it suggests. I like how it unfolds. But I really enjoy this one. I think it's a weird take on Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and I think it does a good job. I think it has good characters in here, interesting characters, and I think like him kind of, you know, exploring his dark side and everything like that. And I like that there is some stuff in here that I directly remember from the story, like the will and everything, leaving it to them and having that discussion and stuff, that I think is more explored in this than a lot of the other Dr. Jekyll stories I've seen. But as far as the special features are concerned, this is the DVD and a Blu-ray in here. We have Appreciation by Critic, Long-Term Borochek Fan, Michael Broke, audio commentary featuring archival interview with Volveri, the director, and new interviews with cinematographer Noel Vary, editor Kajanshin Barha, assistant Michael Levy, and filmmaker Noel Simsolo, moderated by Daniel Bird. Brand new interviews with Uday Kier and Marina Pirro. I love Uday Kier, by the way. Himagori, a short film by Marina and Alessario Pirro, made in homage to Boychuk. Interview with artist and filmmaker Alessario Pirro. Phantasmagoria of the Interior, a video essay by Boychuk's Dr. Jekyll by Adrian Martin and Christina Alvarez Lopez. Eyes That Listen, a featurette in Boychuk's collaborations with electroacoustic composer Bernard Parmigiani. Happy Toy, a short film by the director. And then we have interview with Sarah Milson, former assistant to the director. Then we have interview, we already had that, sorry. Return to Malaise, Boryshak and Early Cinema, featured by Daniel Bird. So we have so much stuff going on here. We have a trailer with a commentary. So it's like literally a packed disc of a really interesting, good movie. So if you slept on this one, you skipped some of the early Arrow, pick this one up during a sale if you can find it. I think that you won't be disappointed. I personally enjoy it quite a bit. You know, it's 7.5 out of 10 or something. I know I don't throw out ratings too much, but this is an interesting one. Second time watch, it's been years, but I'm glad I watched. I remembered a lot too. So if a movie leaves a lasting impression on you, that says quite a bit. Okay, the next one from 1981 is a bizarre one. Now, it's listed as a horror film on Letterboxd, and it's horrific, and it is No Mercy, No Future. Now, this has been compared to Possession, which I could see certain aspects, you know, being in like the area of Germany, and you see the Berlin Wall, the bleak color scheme, all that kind of stuff. It resonates with The Possession. It follows a female character who's obviously mentally ill, going through a lot of problems. Now, where it differs is Possession follows two characters going, which is kind of like an allegory, right, for the director's divorce and everything like that. So you can kind of see that, right? Zudalowski's divorce, like it feels like a divorce film. This one, not so much. This one basically follows a character who's been abused at a young age, and you're basically watching her suffer through life and have these mental illnesses and defects and all this kind of stuff, and her rich parents and all this horrible stuff in her life, and every sexual encounter she has with people, every counter she has, she's taken advantage of to a certain point until she completely loses her mind. And she's in and out of the mental institutions. There's just lots of disturbing imagery and scenes in the film, and kind of almost surreal moments. But everything around looks so dark and so bleak and so cold. And anytime those movies have like the Berlin Wall in there, I'm telling you, it gives that vibes, man, big time. It's scary. Like, I like a list of Letterboxd movies with the Berlin Wall as a backdrop, because there's just something about it that's just fucking really unpleasant, to be honest. And it's just, you can see the poverty and the despair, even when she comes from a rich family. But this movie is she's tremendously well acted in it, but there's a scene involving, you know, post-surgery sex, which I was shocked. It was one of the most weird, crazy things I've seen, where I was like, I can't believe that's in there. That's rough stuff, man. That is very, very unpleasant to watch. But there's a lot of unpleasantries about it. I mean, the movie has a term, racism, in there. It has lots of, stuff in there where she lives with this group of kind of foreigners in the country, and it's just unfucking pleasant, to be honest. Like, everything about it is just one of these kind of characters on the crazy adventure of life, but the life is just hell. It's a hellscape. And she has this religious aspects where she has this, she sees people as gods. So she will bend to their very will, and it's sexualized in her mind, all stemming from these early traumas that she's had. So it's a disturbing ass movie. No mercy, no future. I think the ending, you know, the flame burning out on the cross kind of symbolizes a lot. I would recommend this if you're into like art films. If you like Possession, yes, but like I said, there is similarities, but it's not as horrid. It's not as much of a horror film. It doesn't follow two characters. It's not about that. It's about one character's journey, to be honest. And it's more sympathetic towards this character, I would say. In Possession, both of them are just, yeah, 1 minute, 1 second in Possession, you feel bad for one or the other, and the next, they're just monsters. And this one, I never thought she was a monster. I genuinely just felt bad for her, or was just scared of her at the same time. You know, that kind of character that you want to reach out and help, but you're terrified of, like May or something. But this is a bizarre film. Great performance by the lead here. Kind of hard to duplicate. It would be a hard character to play. It's very unique to her, I imagine. But excellent movie, No Mercy, No Future. Check it out. And now we have another one to follow up, No Mercy, No Future, that's equally as artistic and as amazing. I'm just being a dick. But this is directed by Jerry Warren. This is Frankenstein Island. Now, when I asked the worst movies of 81, people would say Night of Horror, Frankenstein Island. Those are kind of the two big ones that would come up. And I've heard of Night of Horror for years being a pile of crap. Now, Jerry Warren's a name I know, and I know he produced and directed some really cheapy movies. And most of them, I think, were before this, 50s, 60s. I don't know if this movie is like partially finished and they finished. I don't really know the story of Frankenstein Island. I probably should have done some research, but I kind of just wanted to talk about it. So this has a couple iconic people in here. There's some familiar faces, don't get me wrong, but as far as icons, I would say, of course, there's John Carradine in there. Now, you never know what you're getting with John Carradine. John Carradine's in some great films with John Wayne. He's in some great horror films, and he's in some big old fucking turds. I'd say John Carradine might have the worst track record as like kind of the old horror icons, like of just being a pure shit. Now, I like John Carradine. I think he always does a solid job, and I love watching him, but some of the movies he's in are unfucking watchable. It also has Cameron Mitchell. You know, Cameron Mitchell, I love. He's not always in the best movies either, but I love Cameron Mitchell, and I always think he does a good job. Even in from that movie from 1980, Catalyst. What is it? Yeah, Catalyst or something. And I enjoy him in that movie. So basically what we have here is a group of people crash land their hot air balloons on this island, and they're like, what's going on? They land, there's some, I guess you'd refer to them as Amazon kind of savage women, and they're very pretty, of course, scantily clad, and they're like, hey, we know what's going on, help us, yada. So they kind of like start to like go about this island, and they find this weird kind of hierarchy, and there's these kind of strange characters, one of which will not stop fucking laughing, and you find out this is like Frankenstein's Island. There's this old man who's dying, who needs to be kept alive because he directly worked with Dr. Frankenstein, and one of the guys that crash landed on the island Brown's a doctor, and he's like, I want to find all Dr. Frankenstein's secrets. Cameron Mitchell is locked up in this cell, quoting Edgar Allan Poe in kind of a drunken rage, or not rage, but just drunken stupor, I would say. He's finding it. I like watching him. I love watching him. Like I said, he's one of my kind of favorite kind of actors that pops up in this shit. So, and like, he's just a bizarre character. It kind of reminds me, what was that movie? I don't know if I ever watched it, but I've seen clips of it with like Long Chaney when he's in the prison and he's like, doesn't speak any lines because he's too fucking drunk and he died shortly after. I shouldn't say that. This is that Al Adamson movie, I'm sure of it. But no, I mean, Mitchell's not that bad yet. I mean, Mitchell lived for several more years after this, right? But he's just kind of like grizzled and in a stupor, quoting Poe and whatnot. And John Carradine will pop up. It's basically, he's a brain, but he pops up every once in a while just like, I don't know. He literally is like, I don't know what they paid him. He wasn't there. It's like this weird kind of hallucination. He just pops up and starts talking. He's controlling the island from his brain. And at one point, the Frankenstein monster pops up in this giant fucking puddle or underwater cave lake or some shit. And he's like, argh! It looks like crap. But I guess he's the most impressive special effect of the movie. I don't know. I mean, I don't know much to say about Frankenstein Island's bad. It would probably be fun with a group of people just kind of fucking around watching Frankenstein Island. I think you could enjoy yourself, have a couple of laughs, some burgers, some beers. Troubles are fucking over, dude. No, but yeah, I mean, like, seriously, like, it is what it is. I know it got a DVD release years ago. I'm sure it's long out of print. I would buy it. I would buy a Blu-ray of Frankenstein Island like the jackass I am, and I'd be like, I want to watch all the special features and find out what the fuck was going on about this movie. But yeah, I can't recommend this. The ending is terrible. It's fucking stupid. But hey, it is what it is. It's Frankenstein Island from 1981. Better than Night of Horror. Better than Night of Horror. Yeah, much better. So I still have Zombie Lake by John Roland, started by Jess Franco, to get through. And I'd seen that, but it's been years. So, I mean, I guarantee Zombie Lake's better than both Night of Horror and Frankenstein Island, because Zombie Lake has a bunch of nudity in it and just like it, zombies. I mean, it's got to be better. My memory says it's better, but who knows? Yeah. Okay, for the Patreon pick, it was a documentary that won Best Picture that I hadn't seen, so I did When We Were Kings. And yeah, this is basically the documentary about the fight and the rumble in the jungle that took place in, what the fuck country was it, in Africa? I knew I should have had that to memory. Rumble in the Jungle between Muhammad Ali in 1974 and George Foreman. Of course. So George Foreman was on a tear at the time. Everybody knows Muhammad Ali, and George Foreman was favored to win this fight. And this is kind of the backstory here and the epicness of all the whole story and them staying in Africa for a long time and interacting with the African people and how the fight got done. Don King is prevalent in here. Of course, Foreman is prevalent in here. Muhammad Ali is. And it's so cool to see footage of Muhammad Ali, just the way he talks, the way he moves, and everything about it. The guy was so clever, so funny, so charming. It's like so hard to be a great athlete, be funny, be charming, and be like this proactive, like kind of almost political guy who has these good messages, or at least trying to help the people in his mind. Foreman is also intelligent in his own way, watching him talk and everything like that, because he doesn't say a lot, but when he talks, he does get his message across very well. So watching this, it just kind of like took me back to watch these like sports icons and see how intelligent, how much charisma they had and how good they were. And you're just kind of like, man, they really knew how to sell people, but people also were just seemingly smarter. And I hate saying that, like, I really do. People just seemingly were more intelligent back then. And I remember, I this is a weird reference, but I remember the Carl Ponsram documentary and his written works, or his dialogue, how he spoke. He was like, I'm just a dumb idiot. And he would say this like long paragraphs, and what he was saying was much more well-spoken and intelligent than like 50 to 60% of the people nowadays. And this is a dummy serial killer. So I'm just like, I don't know, you know, I'm just being a jerk, I guess. But it was just so weird to see how articulate everyone was in this. And I'm not just talking about the boxers, of course. Now the sports analyst in here that are talking about Muhammad Ali and George Foreman in the time and the first person interactions with them in the time and how the environment was around sounded like they were artists, they were poets, and they were referencing old literature and these things like that. They were pulling from all these things that a sports analyst probably wouldn't do now. Like, they were highly educated individuals, the boxers and the boxing trainers and the sports analysts and all these kind of things like that. And they talk about Don King and Muhammad Ali and Foreman, and they talk about, you know, I felt very dire for Muhammad Ali. Everybody thought it was over for Muhammad Ali. He had lost once to Joe Frazier at the time. And Foreman had walked through Kenny Norton. He had walked through Joe Frazier. Foreman was destroying everyone. This is obviously the famous rope-a-dope story. And later Muhammad Ali would develop Parkinson's, right? So a lot of people think a lot of the damage he took in this fight and other fights is what caused Muhammad Ali to damage that, to develop that disease. I mean, all people say that, but it's also interesting how they look at Muhammad Ali in this country, how they look at him as he's so outspoken in America towards those things. And they go through all the whole idea that he, you know, he was a Muslim, so he didn't go to Vietnam. It's just a really interesting doc, and it was made in the 90s, 96, I believe. And I was taken back by it. I was very intrigued. I loved watching all the talking heads, and they were just, because they were firsthand there to experience it and talk about it, and it just felt like a really interesting time and slice of time that is it'll never happen again. And it was just a different time, and it's very interesting and very well made, and I love watching the film footage. I can't lie. And I mean, the fight too and all that kind of stuff in there, and just watching the highlights, it's just crazy. It's such a crazy time, man. It's so weird to look at athletes back then and just the dynasties and the legacies. Even when you look at wrestling and shit, like, it was, I mean, obviously not comparable to boxing, but you just look how things were advertised. Things were treasured more, I guess. With everything at your fingertips with a click of a button, I mean, things lose their meaning sometimes. Everything gets lost in the shuffle. But excellent. When We Were Kings. Great documentary. It's released by Criterion. If you want to pick it up, watch it on the Criterion channel. I would recommend it. Great stuff. All right. Questions, comments, concerns, and everything else. I shall read now. Ken Coakley. 3959. I want to get The Burning on 4K. The cast is loaded with steady working actors. Jason Alexander even had his full head of hair. He and Fisher Stevens brought humor to the horror movie. Stevens went on to do Short Circuit, as well as my third favorite Matt Dillon film, The Flamingo Kid. Ned Eisenberg had just come off The Exterminator, went on to play Joe Roth, the photographer, who shot the famous a photo of the American flag being raised by raised at Iwo Jima in Flags of Our Fathers. He also appeared in The Sopranos, a guy that Paulie Walnuts hits repeatedly in the head with a service bell. Larry Joshua played the boy at the ended up in Dances with Wolves, as well as two Sam Raimi films for the love of game and Spider-Man as the wrestling promoter. He also ends up in a couple Jimmy Glickenhaus movies. It was my understanding that the film was based on a legend, someone called Cropsey. That is, of course, true. So when I saw the DVD of the documentary, I had to buy it. I watched it, and there was no mention of the film. It was all about the sick bastard abducting and murdering kids with Down syndrome. I was hoping he'd be entertained by the folktale and got an insight of how sick people can be. Yeah, that, I really like that Cropsey documentary because it throws you for a loop. You're like, oh, we'll talk about Madman, and we're going to talk about The Burning, the old tale of the Cropsey campfires, and then you're like, oh, then it changes gears, and it goes right into the murders of Andre Ron. That was the guy's name, and it's just such a scary, fucking horrible story. It reminds me a lot of Session 9, because the mental institution in Session 9 and this whole thing, that whole story with Andre Rand, centered around that mental institution. The Burning's, I'm a big fan of it. Of course, you know, it also had a small role by Holly Hunter was in there, and it's got some other people that recognize the nerdy Alfred Backer, the nerdy guy from Fresh Times at Richmond High. I'm a big fan of The Burning. When we talk about it, I will mention some things too. Mark Stranano, hope you and your health are strong and that they find nothing. Now, the reason for saying this, because my brother, roughly a week before the beginning of June, he went in for a routine checkup, found nothing. On June 7th, he passed away at the age of 57. I'm sorry. RIP to your brother. It can be rough. The Nick Mua, Hugo is highly entertaining, magical story with a great message. It's well on its way to becoming a classic, I think. It's great of Arrow to realize this too and give it an excellent new release. Questions. What's the deal over the U.S.? What's the deal over there in the USA with prom night? Is it a rite of passage? Did you get to go to your prom? And more importantly, are there pictures? I finally saw the Canadian-American classic feature Jamie Lee Curtis, hence the question. I mean, prom's pretty big. From my understanding, everyone goes to prom. It's for seniors. It's kind of like the big last dance for everybody. I did go to prom. And I probably do have pictures somewhere. Not going to show them on here. Two, do you think or fear that the writers, actresses strike will change the movie landscape forever? It's definitely going to change the movie landscape forever. But if they don't go on strike, from my understanding, this whole like AI imaging shit's going to fuck everything up anyways. It probably still will. I mean, honestly, like everything's going to change. AI's been changing stuff for years. I mean, automated stuff has been changing stuff for years. I mean, it's coming for the artistic ones. It is often said people prefer quality over quantity. Do you feel that the more movies a director makes, the bigger chance that the content would become stale or crappy? It all depends on the director, depends on what he's making, depends on his budgets. You know, sometimes when they're on a steady pace, like Carpenter, boom, you got 78, you got Halloween, and Someone's Watching Me, and then 80, you got The Fog, 81, you got Escape from New York, 82, you got The Thing, then 83, you have Christine. 84 Starman, and then 86 Big Trouble in Little China. He didn't really slow down in his great stuff. I feel like if a director gets in his stride, he does some really interesting work. But then you look at Craven, and Craven went 81 Deadly Blessing, 82 Swamp Thing, and then 84 You have Nightmare on Elm Street, but you also have The Hills Have Eyes Part 2 in 85, which isn't great. It's not horrible. And Chiller. So, like, what do you know? Like, it depends on the guy. It depends on, I feel like, if they get a steady budget and they get steady time, I think that they could continue to make one good movie a year for a long fucking time. Nowadays, you get a lot of these guys that make 50 movies a year. They're all based on, you know, namesake only to get put in the red box or get picked up by a small label distro. And that's how they survive. You know, they spend $100 on a movie and they probably make $500 on each movie and they release 50 movies a year. But eventually one of them's going to hit. They're going to make their money and they're going to be able to survive off that. But, you know, I don't know whether there's love in there. Maybe there's love of the grind, love of making movies, but I don't know if those movies are going to ever stand the test of time or be worth a damn if you're making 50 movies a year. So, you know, it is what it is. Not my thing. I tend to gravitate more towards older films anyway. So when you ask, is it going to change the landscape forever? Probably. Yeah, it's definitely going to. I just hope people still appreciate old art film. And he says, I hope you and pray your health problems will soon be a thing of the past. Me too. Make 780 daily one. You can do anything, but not everything. Motivation. Yes. Explosion Action. Another great video. I saw Hugo at the cinema and thought it was great. Love the small Christopher Lee moments. Agree with your Evil Dead Rise review. The one that watches enough for me. Though I did like that Bruce Campbell did the voice on the record that awoke the Deadites again. MJ Ruiz has so many interesting and incredible films. This is reference to The Territory. I think you'd like many of his others too. I think so too. It was a very weird film. Hudson 38383. Don't know if you're a fan of 3D, but if you ever get a chance to see Hugo in 3D, jump on it. It's one of those must-see 3D movies. I don't have a 3D TV, but I would like to have one. They kind of don't make them anymore. Tyler Tadato. Hey, Dave, you really enjoyed Wild Strawberries. You should give Autumn Sonata a spin. Seems like the next step in your Bergman journey. I will eventually, I'm sure. Grateful Buck. Loved Hugo when it was first released. Thought it would interest horror fans for its strange characters, creepy railway themes, and all the menace to a homeless boy living in the station. Yeah, I think so too. Zombie Adams. Thanks for The Territory. Just off to watch it now. Seems right up my street. Cheers, man. You're welcome. And I hope you enjoy it. Lord Mordor. I wanted to like Evil Dead Rise, but I hated how much it resembled a Conjuring movie. Yikes, not for me. Yeah, I mean, like, they're like, this is the Evil Dead movie. And it's more like, I feel similar. I'm not going to lie. I don't hate it. I just don't love it. Stuart George. Love the 80s montage Midway. Me too. Ilk Vomit 88, RAP Lam Ching Ying. There was a story that Lam challenged Bruce Lee in a hotel room because he didn't believe Lee was as strong as the rumors said. Lam put a pillow over his chest and stomach, and then Bruce struck the pillow and sent him flying across the room. Bruce was so impressed that he hired Lam as his personal assistant. Lam was 19 at the time. He was also prone to getting into fights. During the filming of Lee's The Big Boss, Lam was arrested for fighting, and Bruce had to bail him out of jail. Speaking of Bruce, how long until we see Mr. Parker review that awesome arrow set that's just now getting into people's hands? Probably not likely, to be brutally honest. Because I bought the Criterion and I haven't even opened it, and I bought a couple of Bruce Lees before that, so I'm not going to upgrade to the Arrow 4Ks. I'm sorry. I will watch some Bruce Lee movies eventually. Maybe if somebody in the Patreon wants to throw me some Bruce Lee movies, that would be greatly appreciated as well. Now we're going to where's this thing? I'm going to draw five names for the Patreons here. Here we go. No update this time around, but, so five names out of here to see what we're going to be watching. Let me get in the middle of this chunk here. Ooh, how many I got here? I might have more than five, but we're doing that. Okay, wow. Nick Mua, The Entity, from 82, 83, It All Depends. Now, I've never been the hugest fan of The Entity, but it is what it is. Oh, David Luton, They Call Her One Eye. I already covered Thriller, A Cruel Picture, but I will watch it again, and I will watch the Vinegar Syndrome release. How about that? Because I watched the Synapse Blu-ray. I'll watch the Vinegar Syndrome release if you'd like that. If not, get at me, and I'll do something else. Rob, Kelly's Heroes, all the burning bridges that have fallen after me. Big fan of Kelly's Heroes, not watched it in years. So we got six, I think, here. Chris Rivers, The Last Castle, is that the Burt Lancaster film, I believe. I look forward to watching that, anything with Mr. Lancaster. Okay, Tom Brooker, Almost Human, I already have that one, unless you're referring to the other one. If you're referring to the Umberto Lenzi, Tomas Milan movie, I already covered that. But if you're referring to the Joe Biegos movie, I have not. So let me know. And then last, but hopefully not least, Travis Linscomb. What is it? Blu-ray release in 2022, not watched. Bump to top. Okay, so I'll basically grab one of these I'll probably watch an old Vinegar Syndrome from 2022 that I haven't watched. But anyways, thanks guys for watching. I'm out of here. All right, guys, thank you very much for watching. And as always, have a good one.